all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to veteransradio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to veteransradio.net. We want to thank our national sponsors, NVBDC.org. That's the National Veteran Business Development Council, the leading veteran-owned business certification organization developed by veterans for veterans. Find them at NVBDC.org or call 888-CERTIFIED. And also, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm nationwide. You can call them at 800-693-4800 or find them on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dr. Kath Bogey, who is a biomedical engineer and a research scientist at the Lewis Stokes Cleveland VA Medical Center and a professor at the Department of Orthopedics at Case Western Reserve University. We have an interesting issue to talk about, but let's start with Dr. Bogey. Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation.
Well, you have a couple things caught my eye in the news, and I thought, well, I want to talk to this research scientist, engineer, and find out what she can inform our veteran radio listeners about. But your focus has been on chronic wounds, those with limited mobility, including those with spinal cord injury or diabetes, and sort of the wound care necessary for them. And unfortunately, a lot of veterans have these problems either as a result of combat injuries, exposures, or over time as we age, we may all run into these problems. It's an interesting area of focus. But before we get into that, tell us a little bit about your educational background.
Okay, sure. So, well, as you can probably tell, I did not grow up in the United States. I grew up in the UK, and I ended up, my undergraduate degree was in material science, but I had always been working as a nursing aide, actually, and working with people who were wheelchair users from about the time I was 16. And I really didn't want to go to be a clinician, but I wanted to use my knowledge to make a difference for those folks and their quality of life. So I ended up going to do my PhD at the University of Oxford, where I got interested in wheelchairs and seating. And I worked for a short while at the National Spinal Cord Injury Centre at Stoke Mandeville in the UK. And then I moved to Cleveland. And I already had an interest in the challenges of for people with spinal cord injury. From an engineering perspective, I was interested in why some people get pressure injuries, why others don't, what we can do to prevent or to heal them when they do occur. And basically, when I came to the US, I looked at where was providing the best care for people with spinal cord injury, and I found the VA, because they take care of veterans with spinal cord injury for the rest of their lives. And really, if you have a catastrophic injury such as that, lifetime care is what you need to have access to.
Well, and I kind of guessed that wasn't a Cleveland accent, so thanks for giving us the background. And I think our veteran radio listeners do know that the VA provides not only tremendous care, but engages in tremendous research across all sorts of areas, trying to help advance medical science and the care given to veterans. So it does. I was wondering how you got to the VA, and you've explained that, because you do have an international reputation in what's known as translational wound management research. Can you explain to our listeners what translational wound management is all about?
Sure, I can try. So there's a lot of people who look at cells on a benchtop basis and look at, say, drug delivery and see what happens to a cell or cell system. And they look at pathways, biological pathways, which is important, but it's a long way from actually impacting the patient. And then there's folks that look at the human factors, which are also important, and that's much more direct towards the patient care. But what I do is try to take developments or clinical questions. I mean, it's not that I don't sit at the bench and think, oh, I can design a new widget. What I do is listen to the clinicians and the patients who say, we have these issues. How can we address them? How can we do better? And so we go away and say, okay, for example, with the electrical bandage that we developed, the original question wasn't, can we build a better bandage? It was from the clinicians saying, we've used electrical stimulation for our patients, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And we don't know why. We don't know what is making it work, what isn't making it work, what's the best way to deliver treatment. So we took their question and went away and thought, okay, how do we answer this? And in order to answer this question, we needed to look at a range of different treatment paradigms, different ways of delivering treatment, different ways of switching on and off, and comparing them to the clinical, what was used clinically, and to see what worked and what didn't. But what we found was that in order to ask our question, there wasn't actually a device available. So we had to build a device.
That's why the question is a hard question.
Exactly. You know, when we looked at what was available on the market, the sort of technology or the devices that were being used to deliver eSTIM, often they're really marketed as TENS devices or pain management devices. And then it has a button that says switch to pattern 2, but it doesn't tell you what pattern 2 is, which maybe doesn't matter unless you want to know how to make it better, because 2 and 2.5, you don't know what the difference is. So we basically took the information that we could find and developed a bandage that could deliver variable electrical stimulation within a range of clinically appropriate parameters.
Let me try to frame this for our veteran radio listeners, and we're talking to Dr. Kathy Pogge, who's a biomedical engineer and research scientist. In layman's term, this is a smart bandage or a cyber bandage or an electrical bandage that has, you know, we're all used to putting a Band-Aid on that has one function, just mm-hmm. keep it clean, keep it closed, it'll take care of itself.
Right.
But a smart bandage is designed to do something else. Explain what
right.
it's doing.
So what the smart bandage is doing is delivering, this is why it's used for chronic wounds, it's delivering electrical stimulation, which promotes healing across a wound, for a wound, particularly for wounds that don't heal, but also for wounds that are infected or at risk of infection. The electrical stimulation, if used appropriately, can reduce the infection and reduce a specific type of infection that's called biofilm. So when you look at an infection, you can usually see it. It looks nasty, it smells nasty, and you know there's an infection there. But what also happens is another type of sneaky infection that you can't see, which is called a biofilm. Biofilms happen all over the place. They happen in a drain pipe or all sorts of different areas where bacteria kind of get together and set up stable communities. And unfortunately, when that happens in a wound, it stops that wound. It really slows down the healing. And antibiotics don't work. Because these bacteria are so happy, they sit there and they create a little house around themselves, which the bacteria can't get through. which the antibiotics can't get through.
And you know, when you have happy bacteria, what happens?
They're happy, but you're not.
Right, exactly. Nothing good. So this sort of electrical stimulation then breaks that down, and your team came up with a low cost untethered electrical bandage. What's the name of it, and can you tell us where it is in its development stages?
So the current name, it's gone through a few iterations, but the current name is the XEFLEX. And we have, we've done clinical work, and preclinical work, sorry, and we've done work using large and small animals to develop and validate the technology. And I was fortunate enough to be part of the FedTech Spring Startup Studio, which is a program that matches government developed technologies with entrepreneurs who are interested in developing those technologies. And I was matched with a great group of entrepreneurs who really have no knowledge about the biomedical field, but they were interested in this technology. And we went through the program. We were fortunate enough to win. Because what we have is a meaningful product, but it's not quite yet a product. What we have is a prototype that we are building in a research lab. So the next stage is to take it from the research lab, and with my students and my team can build them in tens. What we really need is tens of thousands. And as a university or as a VA medical center, we don't have manufacturing capabilities. So partnering with the entrepreneurs who set up a company called XE, we will be able to manufacture this, translate it from the preclinical work through a clinical pilot to a manufacturable device.
And tell our listeners a little bit, Kathy, about how... From the initial stages of where the clinicians were coming to you and saying, we've got this problem, go think about it, how do we solve this, to where you are today, is this a decade, is this 3 years? Give us a sense of the time frame.
Yeah, it's probably between 10 and 15 years. And it's not that we've been working on this constantly all the time. You know, I am a researcher, so to do research, we need to have research funding, which means we write research grants, we present ideas, and just because the clinicians and the patients think it's an idea doesn't necessarily always mean that the peer reviewers, who are other researchers, necessarily see things as a good idea from the get-go. So that can take time. We have worked on it. We had to have a little break, and then we start again. So there's stops and starts along the way.
Certainly, and it takes a place like a university or the VA medical centers to support that ongoing research over a long period of time before it ever becomes a commercial product.
Absolutely. And one of the things that the VA research program does, which is different from other government funding agencies, is that their focus is on improving the healthcare of the veteran. So they are looking very much at supporting research that is going to directly impact the care of the veteran and the health of the veteran. So, you know, developing interventions and novel approaches that are directly translatable to healthcare. Not in 50 years.
Right. And I want to move on to something else that you've been involved in. And you mentioned it kind of in how you got interested in this area, was working with folks in wheelchairs. And as I mentioned to you, I have a relative who's in a wheelchair. And this idea of the importance of a good wheelchair cushion, I don't think, unless you've been around somebody in that situation, you don't really think about it. Tell us why this problem got brought forward to you. why the clinicians said, hey, can we do something better than what we're doing, and kind of where that led you?
Well, actually, the our cushion project wasn't the clinicians, it was patients themselves. We had a focus group, probably about 10 years ago now, and we were talking to folks who were wheelchair users and asking them about what they needed. And one of the comments that came up was, you know, I can get a high performance cushion, but it's going to cost me a lot of money, and not all these individuals are veterans, so their insurance may not cover it, or if it fails, they don't get it replaced for 5 years. And then on the other hand, you can get a cheap cushion, but that's not going to provide the sort of pressure release, the cushioning that they need in order to avoid the problems of getting pressure ulcers and tissue breakdown. So what they said was, well, can you build us a cushion that is low cost and high performance? So breaking that link between the cost and the performance was kind of what we were charged with.
And you said, wow, that seems like a simple question. How difficult can the answer be?
Well, it wasn't that challenging to think of an answer, but to test it and to prove it, again, takes some time. So what we started with initially, was stress balls. You know, those kind of gel balls that you squeeze when you're feeling stressed.
Sure.
A lot of people are squeezing quite a lot at the moment. So we took those and we thought, well, we could make a modular cushion, a cushion with lots of different gel balls in, with different stiffnesses, and create a cushion that can be fit to the individual. And we did that and we tested it, and the users liked it, and the therapists were reasonably enthusiastic as well. But what they mentioned was, well, this is kind of heavy and that can be a problem. So then we went back and rethought it and thought, okay, so how do we make these inserts, these modules that we put into the cushion, how do we make them lighter but still with this variable stiffness? And, you know, some things happen because it's the right time. We were getting to that stage in the project just as desktop 3D printers started to become more widely available and have actually been deployed throughout the VA through their prosthetics department. And so we used that technology to 3D print what we had been using. What we've been doing with gel balls, we now do is with 3D printed inserts, which we call squish-ins because they are squishy and they go into an insert. And the value is, for this cushion, we can produce a whole cushion for less than $100. It can be fit to a person, to the individual. So it's a customized cushion, which typically costs well over $300 for a fraction of the price. But what we can also do is, if part of this cushion fails or it needs to be altered, you can do that without having to alter or throw away the rest of the cushion. So you don't need a new cushion. You can just replace part of it, and it carries on working just as well as it did before.
Interesting how a change in technology, printers coming online and being used in the medical field, has allowed this low-cost, high-performance, personalized modular wheelchair cushion to be advanced in a way that it probably couldn't have been otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, if we wouldn't have been able to do what we do now, say, when we started the project 10, 12 years ago, because 3D printers were incredibly expensive and very, very industry-specific at the time. So a lot of the development that we have done in our group, it tends to be that if you look at non-medical approaches, quite often the costs will be lower than a medical approach. But if you can integrate the two, use a non-medical approach, for example, 3D printing, in a medical application, you can reduce the costs but maintain safety and efficacy, which is really what we need.
Well, and this is the sort of innovation and creativity that veterans who are seeking health care, whether it's at VA or somewhere else, this can be used by the private sector as well. That would really help veterans get a better quality of life and a better health outcome from this work. So it's kind of interesting to see how these come together. And I wanted to touch one more area that you've worked on, because I think it's, again, nobody wants to think about wound care. Nobody wants to think about being in a wheelchair or having pressure ulcer kind of problems. But you need solutions to these problems. And you have been involved in something called FlexStim. Can you talk about what the problem was and what the solution is?
Okay, so this is a project, again, that is leveraging novel non-medical technologies. One of my very first research projects was looking at using electrical stimulation, but in a different way with the bandage, an implanted electrical stimulation system, which had wires that went to the muscles to stimulate them. So even if somebody has a spinal cord injury, you can quite often stimulate the nerve to the muscle to produce a muscle contraction. And in when it comes to pressure injury prevention, what you want to do is to be able to enable somebody to do weight shifting. And we can stimulate the glutes, the butt muscles, to provide an active weight shift. And we did some work probably 20 years ago where we showed that it was effective. And, you know, I had one user who had been, he had a very high level spinal cord injury, and he was frequently bedridden for 2 to 3 weeks every time. He was a NASCAR fan, and every time he went to a race, he kind of planned to be in bed for 2 to 3 weeks because he knew his skin was going to be causing him problems after that. He got one of these systems, and he was able to go on an 18-hour trip without developing any skin problems. So we knew we were getting an effective prevention there. The challenge was that the wires that were delivering the stims were coming out from the skin. And for some people, that's really not something they want to have to take care of. So what we want to do is develop a fully implanted stimulation, fully implanted system, so that the wires are under the skin and the stimulator that's delivering the current to contract the muscles is also under the skin. And I was fortunate enough to link up with some folks who have developed this very advanced 3D printing technology, where they actually, it's a technique called the nanojet printer, which allows them to print very small circuits, which allowed us to develop a stimulator, and working with collaborators at Case Western who are materials experts, to develop a stimulator that, instead of being in a tin can, like say a heart pacemaker is in a flexible package, and the whole device is a little bit bigger than a stick of gum. And that can be implanted fully implanted and deliver stim to provide weight shifting, so that somebody who is a wheelchair user, who the therapists, you know, they're advised that they should be doing weight shifting every 15 to 20 minutes. Now, I don't know about you, but doing anything every 15 to 20 minutes all day, every day is really hard to remember, especially when you're busy with other daily living activities. So the idea is that this device will provide, this system will provide a backup that will automatically deliver weight shifting at the push of a button. They switch it on in the morning and it keeps on going all day long.
And it's just enough electrical stimulation to make the muscles contract, and that works to avoid pressure ulcers where the skin starts to break down just because it's, you know, there's been just continuous pressure without any movement, that translational movement you talked about. So it's really, that's, I mean, again, the solution sounds, oh, well, that makes sense. That, yeah, I get it now. The coming up with something that's flexible and about the size of a stick of gum is the hard part. But it's a really important,
yeah.
it really is an important step forward to help people have a better quality of life, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, and the reason we came up with it being small and flexible was because actually for that, we talked to the clinicians and I, you know, I work with SCI clinicians who are physiatrists. They're not surgeons. So they don't like doing big incisions. And if you talk to a surgeon, and a small incision to them is about 6 inches long. If you talk to somebody who's not a surgeon, a small incision is, they're kind of like, well, about the size of my thumb. So that was our design specification, as it were. That was the goal that we wanted to aim for, that it would be small enough that a non-surgeon would feel comfortable with placing it outside of the operating room, in a procedure room, so that somebody could come in and have this done as an outpatient.
And a lot of your work is funded by DOD's Spinal Cord Injury Research Program, and you just referred to that field as SCI, spinal cord injury. But for our listeners, yeah, I want them to understand it's that group, if you will, and that funding comes out of DOD, funding comes out of VA and private foundations, and all of that, mm-hmm, is really important to advancing the healthcare causes of our veterans and everybody else. So, Dr. Bogey, give us a little peek. What are you working on now?
Well, I've been very fortunate. As you said, my research has been funded by the Department of Defense, the congressionally directed medical research program, specifically with spinal cord injury research and the VA. And we have just been approved for a new study funded by the DOD, Spinal Cord Injury Research Program, where we're building on some work that we did looking at biomarkers for pressure injury risk. So, you know, ideally, you would love to be able to tell somebody before their pressure injury occurred, yeah, you are at increased risk, just in the same way as we can measure cholesterol in the body. And we have just received funding to start to develop a new blood test based on some preliminary work that we did that indicates that there are biomarkers that circulate in the blood that can tell us if somebody is at high risk. And we're just starting to develop a technology that will hopefully lead to a device that will allow both the clinician and the patient to be able to test their blood with a little pinprick to determine their risk for pressure injuries, just in the same way as people with diabetes do for their blood sugars.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Dr. Keith Bogey, we really appreciate you spending some time today with Veterans Radio to tell us what's been working on and what's coming out of the lab and what might be coming out of the lab in the future. And thank you for all you're doing for our veterans in your field of research and study.
Thank you very much. Well, it's been a pleasure, and I very much enjoyed talking to you.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Veterans Radio needs you. If you like our shows that are informative, surprising stories, and relevant information on what's happening at the VA and the military, we'd like your support. Individual support of $5 to $50 a month or corporate sponsorship of $1,000 to $10,000 would be welcomed. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsorship or support tab, pay online, and keep Veterans Radio on the air.